The poor don't need help. They need investment, according to our guest this hour. They need to be treated as customers and job creators. They need financial literacy education and financial empowerment. We will talk with our guest about how he proposes we bring America's millions of poor people into the middle class. And we will wonder what you think of his ideas and what questions you have. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you think we should approach the poor as an untapped asset? Can boosting entrepreneurship among the poor kickstart our economy? Can capitalism help the poor? Can the poor save capitalism? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is John Hope Bryant, founder of Operation Hope and a best-selling business author. His most recent book is How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Let me say before I say anything else, I just love public radio. And Wisconsin public radio is really best in class. You guys have been doing it since 1917. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we've had some practice at this. And may I say that I love your name. John Hope Bryant, founder of Operation Hope. What is Operation Hope?
It's America's first nonprofit software company. It's the software of human development, reverse engineering poverty, founded after the Rodney King riots in 1992 in South Central Los Angeles, and now has served just over 2 million people, has directed about $2 billion in private capital from banks and other sources into low-wealth neighborhoods. And has raised credit scores, as an example, an average 120 points for its clients. And to the topic that we're going to talk about today, nothing changes your life more than God or love than moving your credit score 120 points. Mm-hmm. So we have empowered people and empowered communities to help them help themselves. And I think that our best years are ahead of us, actually. I think that in many ways what we've been doing for 22 years now has been research and development, R&D. I think we've now just went public with this book, June 2nd. And we have a chance to help America lift and leverage itself back into a very healthy future.
Well, let me ask you, just kind of setting the stage here for the issue that that you're addressing. When you say rebuilding the path to the middle class, give us a sense what happened. Why does that path need rebuilding?
Well, let's just speak right to your listeners. If they're making $50,000 a year or less, they feel poor. I mean, that's half of this country, by the way. You've got too much month at the end of your money. Middle class used to be one parent working, even blue collar, working a factory job or whatever. Didn't have to be white collar. It was one parent working. One parent stayed home as a domestic engineer and raised the child or children. Today you have two parents working. It's typically white collar, not blue. You don't feel like you're making any more money. You really don't feel that your child's going to have a better life than you've had, which is a first since probably World War II that a generation has felt that in America. And you're struggling. And you're stressed, and you're arguing with your mate over money. Number one cause of divorce is money. You're finding you've got hypertension and so on and so forth. But most importantly, your hope meter is down. And that's just not America. I mean, America has always been about this middle class. You know, in real statistical terms, the wages for middle class workers really has stayed stagnant, and in some cases has reversed course if you factor in inflation over the last 40 years. And there are reasons for all of this, and we can get into some of the factual data of why people feel that we're off course. They're right. We are off course. We're still a great country. We're the best country in the world. But we have lost our storyline. The magic of America is this middle-class dream.
Yeah.
And it's stalling. And when it stalls, everything else is at risk. And I believe in America, and I believe in her people. And I believe that we are not a country, we're an idea. And we can reimagine ourselves to be anything that we choose. And one of the things that we have chosen is to be a democracy, yes. But we are a democracy rooted in capitalism. And again, I don't want to get ahead of myself in the conversation, but those two things go together in America. And it's democratic capitalism or capitalist democracy or free enterprise democracy, however you want to put it. But aspirations and doing well and doing a little better than your parents did and being able to participate in American prosperity is part of the American DNA. And when half of Americans are struggling, that's a problem. I mean, 70% of Americans, Joy, are living from paycheck to paycheck. 70.
Yeah.
But, so this is not a make it very clear, even though Operation Hope started in South Central LA and dealing with primarily response to a black issue, black American issue in South Central LA, no different than the civil rights issue. This is not this is not about black people. This is about freedom for America. I mean, whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow today, you want to see some more green, as in U.S. currency. It's a class issue now, not a race issue. You deal with class, you get a race for free.
Why did you choose to focus on capitalism in the title of the book? How the poor can save capitalism? Capitalism needs saving?
Yes, it needs a massive software upgrade. You've got, I mean, capitalism is like this double-edged sword. It's a horrible system, really. Very much like democracy, except for every other system. I mean, nothing else works even remotely close as well. China, a pure-play communist country, has adopted Western capitalism. Russia, who I've got some very serious concerns about these days, a communist country, has adopted Western capitalism. Maybe the only way we're going to end up pulling them back from this ridiculousness, by the way, is through their economic motivation. In China, 500 million people were pulled out of poverty over the last decade through Western capitalism. Capitalism has done good things here for some people. As I've already said, after World War II and when the government inspired everybody with, after the military service, you could go get the GI Bill, a mortgage, and so on and so forth. That was a free enterprise mechanism. The government inspired it and induced it. But everything else was sparked by the free enterprise system. So let me come down back to your question. What gets me is, and this is a light that just went on in my head, it's not like poor people and middle-class folks and working-class folks and folks listening to your radio program got a memo on free enterprise and capitalism, and we screwed it up. We never got the memo. This book is in many ways the deliverance of a memo that's 150 years delayed. On March 3rd, 1865, right after signing the Emancipation Proclamation, which everybody who is thoughtful knows about in this country, setting slaves free after slavery, so on and so forth, Lincoln signed another piece of legislation that nobody knows about. It's called the Freedmen's Bureau Act. The first act of the Freedmen's Bureau Act was to create the Freedmen's Bank. That was March 3rd, 1865. Hmm. The Freedmen's Bank's mission was to teach free slaves about money. Now, Joy, this is mind-blowing to me. Right after slavery is over and he gives them emancipation, he thinks the most important thing he can do is teach them about financial literacy? Are you kidding me? So across the street, so next to the bank, next to the White House on the left was the Department of War. It's now the old Executive Office Building. Next to the White House to the right is the U.S. Treasury Department. You know, Washington's proximity to power. You put the things most important to you close to you as the president. Right across the street, Joy, was the Freedmen's Bank. Right across the street is now Bank of America. It's the Treasury Annex in Bank of America. He wanted to see it when he came home at night. He went up to the residence and make sure that the candles were burning, that people were working. One of his generals then proposed, give every free slave 40 acres of mule. It's good for them, it's good for America. But he wanted to also teach them the language of money, so they knew what to do about it, and give them access to capital. He was killed 2 weeks later. And if you want to come back to this, I want to talk about what you want to talk about versus what I do, but you want to come back to it and come a little deeper in the details but and what went wrong. But he was killed 2 weeks later. The bank went off the rails. It had 70,000 black depositors. So people who had been enslaved, had been brutally treated by this country, still believed in this country, believed in themselves, believed in the American dream, and believed it could work for them, and put their money in the bank anyway. When the bank failed, Frederick Douglass, who was a Colin Powell at that time, said the failure of the Freedmen's Bank did more to set freed slaves back than 10 more years of slavery. Boom, 100 years pass, and then you've got 1965. Here comes my mentor, my hero, Ambassador Andrew Young, working with his friend, Dr. King, in the Civil Rights Movement. Also not about black people. Dr. King said, I'm here to set forth a movement that is about saving black men's bodies and white men's souls. We're all in this mess together. It's about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and eradicating the triple evils of war, racism, and poverty. He was setting at liberty America, not black people. He was the only black man talking to white America. That made him different. He had a strategy that made him unique, and he had an inclusive view. And that made him inspirational. And then in 68, he launched the Poor People's Campaign, which was about all races of people, because there's more poor whites in America than poor anybody else, as an example. He was killed 2 weeks later, 2 weeks before this first march on Washington. He never got to his first march. He was killed. We never got the memo, Joy.
Yeah. And what you want to talk about is fascinating, John, but I do want to sort of set the stage here as to you know, the ideas in your book. Why do we need the working class, the poor, for economic growth?
Because they are economic growth. Mm-hmm. I mean, people say, well, why? You know, how can the poor can save capitalism? Statistically, they already are. 70% of a $16 trillion economy that we call the United States of America is driven by consumer spending. Today. Mm-hmm. Literally, you and me paying for coffee this morning, paying car notes, paying mortgages, rent statements, paying utility bills, not even that sophisticated, having breakfast, stopping at a restaurant. It's all those little microtransactions are driving the largest economy on the planet. 30% of our economy is big business and government. But let's go even deeper. And this is for the rare cynic that's listening to your show still doesn't believe, and I know all optimists listen to your show. If you are driving an automobile today, that was a toy for the wealthy when it first came out. Restaurants were luxuries for the wealthy when they first came out. Toilets were luxuries for the wealthy. Cell phones, my favorite topic, luxuries. I mean, I don't know, Joe, you may be too young for this statement, smile, but when I was growing up, I had a brick, Motorola brick, cell phone on my shoulder. It was 10 pounds.
I didn't have a cell phone when I...
Okay, well, you knew of somebody who had one. Well, this is almost... You're making my point. Mm-hmm. It was a very rare group that had these $3,000 Motorola bricks. They were 10 pounds, almost. And it was $3,000. And I had one. And it was a status symbol. Well, it was 45 cents a minute. Today, Africa will probably become the first wireless continent. They're jumping right over landline phones. Landline phones were also a luxury for the wealthy when they first came out. And they're just, people don't have running water and toilets in Africa, but they've got cell phones. You have almost more cell phones in Africa than you've got people. You got more cell phones in the world this year than you've got people. But these were all started as luxuries for the well-to-do. But you can't create a market economy based on the 1%, 2%, 10%. Going back to your original question, of the middle class at risk. You've got 85 people in the world today, God bless them, by the way, who have more wealth than 3.5 billion people on the planet. That's just not sustainable. Yeah. It's just not sustainable. So capitalism, the wealthy need the poor to do better if for no other reason than to stay wealthy. And the poor are driving the largest economy in the world, not the least of which taking care of all of the needs and the responsibilities and the support, all the support functions for the wealthy and the well-to-do. That's a separate sideline conversation. But just on this issue of commoditizing industry, if Henry Ford, one of the great examples here is that he built an automobile and paid his workers enough to buy the automobile that they were building. Boom, created a middle class, helped to spark a middle class. Now you go, your listeners are driving down the freeway or wherever. Look to the right, left. Look at a gas station. Inside of it, a little restaurant. That was a luxury for the well-to-do. You got a cell phone, most of them right now. That was a luxury. It was the least of these God's children that commoditized these products and made them available to everybody. And by making them available to everybody, it lifted the shareholder value. It made them profitable. It gave them it gave the wealthy a base. So we literally are all connected and interconnected together through this economic system. And the largest retailer in the world is not Neiman Marcus, who's part of a group that I serve on the board of. It's Walmart. The guy, Sam Walton, who drove a pickup truck to work every day. That's the largest retailer in the world and the most profitable. Once again, the working poor, the struggling class, the teetering middle class are lifting, leveraging, and stabilizing the largest economy on the planet through their consumer spending. And those who make $50,000 a year or less put 80 to 90% of every dollar back in the economy, unlike the well-to-do who tend to keep more than 50% of every dollar that they make.
Let me jump in because we are past our first break time, but when we come back, we will talk more about how we can lift or bring more of America's millions of poor into the middle class, and we'll welcome your solution. 1-800-642-1234 or your question for our guest. Our guest is John Hope Bryant. He is author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. John Hope Bryant is also founder of Operation Hope and a best-selling business author. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest says that capitalism is the answer to bringing people who are working class or teetering middle class back into the middle class. He says we need to do this by teaching financial literacy, by giving them the tools to start businesses, by restoring their hope. And we wonder what you think. Well, you talked a little bit, John, about how important financial literacy was way back at the end of the Civil War, but that never really happened. Why is it that we need to teach more financial literacy?
Well, imagine everybody listening to your show, being on the freeway, and nobody has a driver's license or driver's ed or had an uncle who told them how to drive a car, yet everybody's life is at risk from people next to them going between 50 and 80 miles an hour. That would be quite dangerous. That's essentially what's going on right now in the economy.
Yeah, so we just need more classes in school, or what exactly are you calling for?
No, you want to put a kid to sleep, give them a traditional literacy course.
Mm-hmm.
You need role models to inspire and spark. You got to connect education with aspiration. So financial literacy should be a requirement. Let me start there. It should be a legal requirement in school. Frankly, I think home economics, you should tie financial literacy with tools and how to raise a family and be a responsible adult, but that's another topic. But I think financial literacy is like breathing. It's the language of money. If you don't understand the language of money and you don't have a bank account, you're an economic slave in America today. So you really need the basics of how this system works embedded in schools, and then you need to connect that with aspiration and connect that with a role model so that kids can see what that leads to. When I was 9 years old, I got my first financial literacy course in Compton. Banker came in my classroom, white banker, happened to be Caucasian, red shirt, red tie, white shirt, blue suit. And I asked the banker, what do you do for a living? And how'd you get rich legally? And I was serious. And he said, I'm a banker, and I finance entrepreneurs. I said, I don't know what an entrepreneur is, but I want to be one.
Mm-hmm.
Changed my life. And it all the endorphins on the right side of my brain started firing. To make a long story short, the next year I started my own business, 10 years old, borrowed $40 from my mother, started the neighborhood candy house in South Central LA. I'm sorry, in Compton, California. Made $300 a week.
Wow, good for you.
Put the liquor store out of the candy business.
So when we're talking financial literacy, what skills, what knowledge does this entail?
It is teaching a new foreign language, which is the free enterprise system. 100 years ago, agrarian farmers did this for their children. It was called Junior Achievement. Everybody knows that program today. It's a great program, but it was created by agrarian farmers who wanted to teach their children how to grow up and run their business. It wasn't a nice goody-two-shoes sweet program. It was about serious legacy and wealth transfer, not wealth transfer, but wealth inheritance with responsibility so the kids could sustain the enterprise. So we need to give young people the tools to compete. When you do that, you crush the dropout rate. Why is that? Kids are dropping out of high school at a 30 to 70% rate today in America because they don't think education is relevant to their future. It's really simple. Most kids want a good job or a shot at economic opportunity. They're not seeing school giving them either of those. So if you're in a low-wealth neighborhood, urban or rural, unfortunately, you see a lot of distractions in middle school, and your kids are dropping out mentally in middle school and physically in high school. And in where I grew up, kids see rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers as examples of success. And so then why should anybody be surprised that that's what they want to be? There's nobody in a suit there. There's nobody who's a businessman or an entrepreneur or a businesswoman. But we're all aspirational. If we can connect financial literacy in school with aspiration in school, with the tools for connecting school with succeeding in life, connect that with a role model in the proper environment, stoke that. And we're actually through Whole Business Box Academies, some of the solutions in the book, we're giving kids Gallup Strength Finder on the front end of their experience so we know, and they, more importantly, they know what they're good at, because half of poverty is low self-esteem.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. We are talking with John Hope Bryant. He is the author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism. And our next caller is Josh in Madison. Hi, Josh.
Good morning, Joy. My question to Mr. Bryant is, do you think that cash transfers could play a larger role in the United States economy, and if that would help out the poor and the middle class and build a stronger economy, if solutions like the Bolsa Família in Brazil, something similar, could work in the United States, and if you'd like to see that implemented, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Cash transfers are very powerful, untapped reservoirs for empowerment, in part because this nation was built by immigrants. And I'm not talking about Mexican immigrants. I mean, and I cover this in the book. The book, you know, all of our ancestors are immigrants. My ancestors got here a little differently, but you know, from Europe mostly, and now we call ourselves American. But 40% of all the Fortune 500 founders are today immigrants, and at the very lower end of that spectrum, the working poor and the struggling class, many of those are immigrants that come here working hard. And those transfer payments without financial literacy circle once in your community, twice, three times maximum, and then out again. But when you have financial literacy in the language of money, you combine that with a tool like transfer payments.
What exactly is a cash transfer?
Well, I mean, there's a couple cash transfers. I believe he's talking about remittances, actually, that come into the United States from. So you have a relative in Mexico, and you're living here legally. Your relative can send you money, or what's really happening in most cases, the person's here sending money back to Mexico, spurring the economy in Mexico. And many of the economies in the world are actually triggered by enormous transfer payments or remittance payments outside of the U.S. back to their home country, Nigeria being one of them. If he's talking about transfer payments in the sense of Social Security and other things, then the one I would focus primarily on is an untapped transfer payment called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which we actually empower through our Hope Inside locations. Unfortunately, the listener got off before I could ask him a more detailed question. But broadly speaking, transfer payments and remittances are huge untapped reservoirs for potential empowerment. EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, is a credit for working. So this is not technically what he was talking about, but it's parallel. But working poor who make $50,000 or less give back $10 billion a year in money that they've earned that they just have never claimed. That's one out of four Americans. And if you qualify for it, it's retroactive for 3 years. So if you make $28,000 a year and you're a teacher in Wisconsin and you have two children, the government owes you $4,000. If you haven't filed, Joy, it's retroactive for 3 years. That's $12,000. That's enough money to send your kid to a nice state college, to pay off your car note, to cure your mortgage. But if you don't have financial literacy and you don't have this memo, we tend to waste that money. In the black community, the money used to come in our neighborhood and stay 27 times. It would circulate 27 times back in the 20th century. And now it comes in and circulates once and leaves. And that's one of the reasons why poor people stay poor. So I'll stop now because I know you want to.
Yeah, no, I actually wanted to circle back to something you brought up right in the very beginning of this interview as to one of the things you're able to accomplish with your Operation Hope, raising the credit scores of so many people and how important that was. I wanted to follow up on that particular item. Why was this? What did you do to improve their credit scores, and why was this so important?
Well, one of the reasons it's so important is that half of all employers require a credit check before they'll hire you today. So your credit score is, in my opinion, the financial literacy is a civil rights issue, period. And I think that things like your credit score that has more of a determinant on your life almost than your skill set, because it really determines how far up the corporate ladder you can go. And what we're doing at Operation Hope, as an example, is through Project 5117, which is one of the solutions in the Hope Plan, our Marshall Plan for today, in the book, is we're going inside of bank branches. Hope inside of bank branches. Our goal is 1,000. So we're going to be the Starbucks of financial inclusion by 2020. And we're going to do HUD-approved mortgage counseling, certified consumer credit counseling, homeownership counseling certification and funding, small business counseling certification and funding, the bundling of public services, which include transfer payments, which I believe the gentleman was talking about, the Earned Income Tax Credit. But most importantly, we're going to sit down with you, pull your credit report, and walk through why you'd be declined for a loan, and then do thick file underwriting, copies of utility bills, copies of rent statements, copies of phone bills. There's all kinds of forms of credit that don't show up in your credit report. We're going to give you credit for that, no pun intended. And then we start working with you, and over about 24 months on the outside, 6 to 18 months on the inside, we help you, we don't do it, we help you move your credit score, which then increases your self-esteem, which is, again, a real determinant of poverty, is low self-esteem, and your confidence in yourself. This is really, Joy, about building confidence in yourself, which is all, it's all this is a nation of confidence, which then leads to dreamers. But you got to have underneath that the mechanics and the tools. And when you move your credit score 74 points, like Ebony Brown did, in 10 months, from 550 to the low to mid 600s, it changes your entire life. And that's what we're doing community by community. If you look at a typical neighborhood, a poor neighborhood, you have a check cashier next to a payday loan lender, next to a rent-to-own store, next to a title lender, next to a liquor store. That's not racism. That's target marketing, Joy. They're targeting a 500 credit score customer. We're going to rob them of their customer.
What is the role of hope, of self-esteem, in alleviating poverty?
This is probably the most radical thing in the book. For 50 years, we've said that poverty is a number. It's 23,000. Now we say it's 23,000 X dollars a month for a family of four. No, that's how you identify poverty. It's not how you prescribe it or change it, because we're human beings, not human doings. So half of poverty is just low self-esteem. It's lack of belief and confidence in yourself. Without confidence, you couldn't do this radio program. Without confidence, I couldn't talk to you with any articulation. Without confidence, you can't get up in the morning and go run and lead your life. But the poor and the struggling have enormous self-esteem and confidence issues. If you don't know who you are in the morning, by dinner time, somebody is going to tell you. And if I don't like me, I'm not going to like you. If I don't feel good about me, I'm not going to feel good about you. So half of all success or failure deals with this issue of personal confidence, belief in yourself, and faith. That's the real wealth. Then that then pivots to its parallel, which is role modeling. Why am I a businessman? My father was. You know, why are you doing what you do? At some point you saw somebody and said, I can do that. It's not rocket science. It's role modeling. Go back to the drug dealing example I gave you. The kids who want to be rap stars, athletes, and they're not dumb, they're not stupid. They're not, you know, they're actually brilliant. They're modeling what they see. They look in their neighborhood and see the only symbols of success, and they want to model that. It's actually very very inspirational to see that they actually do want to be better. They just don't have a better example to be. And then, so the role modeling piece is critical. And that is critical, and that ties to self-esteem. That builds your self-esteem. It's like that banker came in my classroom. That's why I say financial literacy and role modeling has to be connected. And then environment, your family environment, your neighborhood environment, your community environment. If you hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th, because success builds on success, and so does failure. And then that leads to the last piece, which is aspiration, code word for hope. An opportunity. The most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. Well, why wouldn't you have any hope? You got low self-esteem. It's connected. So we have been trying to solve the problem with good intentions, but with the wrong tools and the wrong strategy. To quote my friend Jim Clifton, CEO of Gallup, we're digging in the wrong holes.
Well, we'll try to dig in some of the right holes as we continue. Talking with John Hope Bryant. He is the founder of Operation Hope, best-selling business author. His most recent book is How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. What do you think of his plan? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with John Hope Bryant, who says that we can use things like financial literacy, giving poor people the tools to start their own businesses and restoring their hope will be one way to rebuild the path to the middle class. We are talking with him about his book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, and we're welcoming your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Scott in Duluth. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Joy, and Mr. Bryant. Pleasure to hear you and your enthusiasm. My concern is that I think capitalism is threatened by Washington and the way that the system is run in our country, and the rules that are basically handed down from Washington. The rulemaking system is broken because we have a campaign finance system that allows big money to go in and basically write the legislation and make the rules, and they affect all of us. And until we change that system, I think that the sustainability of capitalism is in doubt.
A response to that?
He's right for a different reason. He's right that the system is broken, but the system is broken in large part because you got a lot of people in Washington who actually don't understand the system he just talked about. If you're not meeting a payroll, if you haven't been an entrepreneur or a small business owner, if you've never created wealth, it's hard to understand the challenges of a small business owner. And why am I connecting that to what he's saying? The magic of America is that since 1978, we've had more small business births than we've had small business deaths. For the first time since 78, Joy, we've had, in the last couple years, more small business deaths than we have small business births. You can say that part of that is because Washington's job or the government's job is to create an enabling environment. And then let us blossom. Let us go and do great things. What America needs right now is 1 million startups a year. We've got, you know, 400,000 deaths and 350,000 small business startups or births. That if we keep along that path, we will be the UK in 10 years. We'll be the nation that used to help lead the world. So we've got to get, well, if we had 1 million startups a year, you'd have enough jobs, you'd have enough prosperity, you'd have enough GDP. And by the way, Pete, you know, the way you deal with campaign finance and the other issues he's dealing with is you need people to vote. We've got enormously low voter turnout rates. Why are people not voting? Because they're not stakeholders. Why are you not a stakeholder? Because you don't own anything. If you don't own anything, you're not concerned about voting. If you're not a stakeholder, it all comes back, I hate to say it, comes back to the issue of money and financial literacy. Why are voter turnout rates so low in low-wealth communities? Because people are not stakeholders. That then ties to a tax base. If you don't own anything, you don't pay any taxes. Well, there's no taxes to pay. Then there's no dollars for schools. There's no dollars for roads, infrastructure. And you're not pushing against Washington to change anything because you don't have a stake in what you're changing. In fact, you've lost hope. All of these things are interconnected, but he's got to not give Washington so much credit, Joy. He's got to understand that he's the one in charge of America. He's the one. That's what the book says. The consumer is the king. And once you understand the facts and the figures and where jobs come from and where GDP comes from and where power comes from, you take that power back. And then you go in your local city hall and you go in your county state houses and you force change. People, politics didn't come first in this country. Ownership came first. Private enterprise came first. The politics was created to protect your individual property rights. We've got it backwards, and we've given up too much of our power.
Well, what about, do you see a role for government in your goals?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I've talked a little bit about it with the Earned Income Tax Credit. I talked about a little bit about transfer payments. I talked about how we're going to bundle public services. I mean, government, one of the biggest entitlement programs is Social Security. I mean, a huge entitlement program in the last 100 years was the GI Bill. Everybody has benefited from government, not just the poor and the working class. You know, welfare came from white rural communities, not black urban ghettos. We're all in this mess together. You need roads and infrastructure and a subway to make New York work. I mean, what talking about free enterprise? It's a bastion of free enterprise. But if the subway system goes down and the roads are closed, free enterprise button turns off. So yes, the government has an enormous role to play in creating the positive environment of what the gentleman just talked about negatively, an enabling environment where things move. Let me tell you the opposite of that. France, they hired a president who said down with capitalism and down with rich people and this tax them at 75% rate and everybody felt great. That's great. That's fantastic. And now the economy's in free fall. Unemployment's gone through the roof. He's now reversing course. He's now saying give small businesses breaks. And that's the key. Hopefully, I don't talk so long, we can't get to one of the big ahas here in this book of where jobs really come from, because it's not where people think that they do. And that's the thing that everybody can do to change America.
Well, we'll get there in just a moment, but I am trying to have you talk a little, as an example, we should be spending less money on welfare and more money on small business loans. I'm trying to get a sense as to what,
yeah.
You know, the
I mean,
different.
Well, yes, look, Saudi Arabia put, I had a guest from Saudi this weekend at my home. They have put their citizens to sleep. I mean, they've given them welfare. They don't call it welfare, but the entitlement payments, transfer payments, for 30 years. Now you got a whole generation of young people in Saudi Arabia that don't know how to work. Should there be a safety net? Absolutely. Should the safety net become a mattress? Absolutely not. You actually rob people of their ability to be self-determined. What's freedom in America? Self-determination. So we need more of that money to go into education that ties into to aspiration. Here's just one example. At Operation Hope, we've got these Hope Business in the Box academies, and the government can fund what I'm about to get to. We start with the Gallup Strength Finders. tell you what you're good at. Then a course in financial literacy. The government can mandate financial literacy. Then a course in dignity, basically values, through an individual role model comes into the school. Then a course in entrepreneurship. Then 25 businesses you can start for $500 or less. Think Shark Tank for kids. We do a pitch event in the kids' auditorium. Shark Tank for kids. Kid gets 2 minutes on stage, pitches their business idea. Go. Local business leaders on stage. This is a partnership now between government, community, and the private sector. The kid pitches well. The guy or girl on the stage, the business leader says, great, you're approved. We fund the business up to $500. Now, Operation Open started doing this on our own. We just put our own money in. We got people joining in the movement, raising $500 to $50 for a kid's business. But the government can start in a fund with a minor amount of money, a minor portion of what they spend on transfer payments and other government programs for something like this. And this kicks all the endorphins in the right side of the kid's head. Now the kid is invested in themselves and their idea. We then put the money into a bank account. Hello, the government can mandate a bank account at birth, an electronic bank account at birth that sits in a private enterprise institution. And then we assign a business role model to them. The person stands up the business, the kid stands up the business, and Gallup Hope Index measures of impact on the back end. And where do we think Steve Jobs came from? What do you think Michael Dell and all these young entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley came from? All these young kids with ideas in high school and college. But college wasn't speaking to a lot of them, so they dropped out. Dell dropped out. Steve Jobs dropped out. Gates dropped out of college. Ted Turner dropped out of college. And go on and on. Larry Ellison dropped out of college. It wasn't speaking to them.
Let me take a call about college from Rich in Manitowoc. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Mr. Bryant. How are you?
I'm blessed.
Yeah, good. Thank you. My question or comment is something I observed about 5-6 years ago. My children were getting ready to go to college, and my wife, she went to a private university in Decorah, Iowa. And the alumni were there, her friends, and we're all professional people. We're all working. All four couples are all working professional jobs, and we were discussing where our children were going to college, and not one of our children could afford to go to that university, even though all of us were working, all eight of us, and the generation before, the parents were just one parent working, and they were able to send their children to a private university, get a vacation house on a lake, and enjoy life seemingly better, but not as busy. And my comment, real quick, is I'm kind of you want us to get to the middle class, and we've gotten to the middle class, but there are a lot of frustrations once you get to the middle class that I don't see a solution for.
He's making my case. So you want to, your question, Joy, is where should the government weigh in? Here's where the government can weigh in. Education should be a right of every American, because without education you can't compete in society. And if you have the average kid with $100,000 to $200,000 of college debt, that's their mortgage payment. They'll never buy a house because they can't afford to. So for the good of America, we need to transfer our priorities and our budget priorities to things like teeing up an education for all. Again, these are ideas covered in the book. There are 20 solutions I have in the book. This is one of them. He raised the issue about how middle class used to be one parent working. It's now two parents working. He doesn't feel like he's participating in this American dream. He basically said he doesn't think his children can do better than he does. If his hope light goes off, if he stops believing in this American dream, we're done. We're toast. And it's so important that he feels supported. You need a bunch of enabling legislation, plus an enabling environment on the ground and the right focus to allow this gentleman and his children to aspire to be anybody they want to be. Now, there's an alternative for his children. In my book, I talk about a guy named Eric who went and got a $36 notary stamp. He didn't go to college. I mean, he went to community college, I think, but he didn't go to a big college and pay a lot of tuition. $36 notary stamp from the city of Atlanta. He's making $17,000 a month. A month. You can be a plumber and do better than a lawyer. You can be an electrician and do better often than the local doctor. There are 25 careers that you can start with 1 year of practical education that everybody needs. But we've forgotten, these are the careers that sort of the backbone of America. I mean, Jesus was a carpenter, for God's sakes.
Yeah. So talk about some of your aha moments where the jobs are.
So in 1970, all jobs basically came from big business. And 4% of all jobs came from one company, AT&T. And, Joy, this is basically where America's stuck at. We've got this stuck in our head. We haven't, done a software upgrade. We still think that that's the case. 4% of all jobs came from AT&T. All jobs came from big business. Here's where it is today. 300 million Americans, largest economy in the world, 26 million companies of the 300 million Americans. Of the 26 million companies, how many create one job or more? 6 million. Of the 6 million that create one job or more, 974 employ 10,000 people or more. And you can name the companies. You know, Microsoft, IBM, Google, HP, Wells Fargo. You can name them. This is a short list. What are we telling our kids? Go to school K-12. Go get a high school diploma. Go get a college degree. Go work for a big company or a big business. Neither of which are hiring. So then where do jobs come from? Half of all jobs in America come from small business with 100 employees or less.
Mm-hmm.
70% of all jobs in America come from companies with 500 employees or less. My guess is Wisconsin Public Radio has less than 500 employees, maybe less than 100. Operation Hope has 250 employees. That's where 70% of America works. But we don't give ourselves any credit for it. We don't even recognize it. We're looking for love in all the wrong places. So where do jobs growth come from? Startups, shoot-ups, entrepreneurs, small business owners in years 3 through year 7. That's who's hiring. That's where jobs come from. And that's what legislation should be enabling, to go back to that million startup number I mentioned earlier. If we had a million startups a year, literally our problems would go away. Silicon Valley saved America. Joy?
Let me bring one last caller in for our last question. Lori in Hills Corners. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Yes, I belong to a social justice committee, and I belong to a citizens coalition group. Are there some actual steps that we can take to support these ideas? Not just to have somebody come out and lecture to us. It often stops there.
So what's next?
Yes, ma'am. Go to Project 5117, Google search, or Yahoo search, whatever your search engine is, Project 5117. You can make your own commitment in your own neighborhood to save your own block, your own street, to create a 700 credit score club in your own neighborhood, to start a whole business box academy, to do financial literacy in your own neighborhood. It's open source software. 70% of our software is open source. It's free. You just make a commitment to help, which costs no money. We help you help yourself empower your community. And then if you're really enthusiastic, we will try to bring a Hope Inside location inside of a bank branch or credit union or grocery store in your neighborhood. We'll partner with your government, your school district, to bring a whole business box academy into your school to do what I said earlier. But you can do a lot of this without me. On your own, we've created the environment, the enabling environment, and we give you the tools to succeed. So, yes, PhDs are good, talk, but PhDs are better. And we are PhD focused.
Thank you so much for being with us.
God bless you. Thank you.
John Hope Bryant, author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We'll have more information and advice on your money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. On Your Money, tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.